Hello, and welcome to the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio. From creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets, here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. I'm not even that tired. That's not important. What's important is this is episode 237. I'm Vincent Diamante, just hanging out here in SoCal, down the street, relatively speaking, from Mike Shapiro over there. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm doing splendidly. I'm glad we're sticking to the convention that north is up and south is down, even though that's fairly random. But just because that's how we see maps, we tend to think of space that way.
Yeah, it works great. I am basically down the street. It just happens to be the 405, right. but it is a single street that, isn't it?
Right. It matches the definition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just a pretty smooth, light, mellow episode since it's just the two of us. Alex is having fun, doing family social stuff and listening to some fantastic music. I think he mentioned in the previous episode that Shostakovich would be involved.
As we speak, as we record this, he is sitting down to listen to Shostakovich 5 with his son.
That's pretty cool. When was the last time that you went out to a classical music concert?
That's a really good question. And I think the interesting distinction is, has it been after the pandemic? I know that I went to something at Disney Hall. It was after the pandemic. Okay, I'm proud to say I have seen live classical music post-pandemic. It was Disney Hall. I'm drawing a blank on what it was, but I know the composer is alive. So it was definitely contemporary. I have mental images, but I don't have sonic images, so I'll have to dig it up. But the much shorter answer is yes. How about yourself?
It hasn't been in the last few years. It was definitely back in the 2010s. But I know it was John Adams, actually. It was at the Disney Hall. It was great. I really enjoyed it. It's been a while since I've listened to any classical concert music, whether classical or, you know, modern concert art music. It's been a while. I need something. I've been seeing some flyers. I'm actually down in Orange County these days, compared to back in the 2010s when I was in Los Angeles. And so I'm seeing things about the various classical venues here. And I keep on thinking, yeah, I haven't checked any of these things out. It might be some classical or romantic composers, or it might be something like Jacob Collier or something like that. I haven't been to one down here in Orange County, and I probably should.
Yeah, you've got some really good venues down there. I forget the name of that big arts complex in Orange County, but you probably know the one
I'm talking about.
Is it
the Segerstrom?
Yeah. That's a great venue. I've seen the Nutcracker there twice and a number of concerts. It's really... You know, John Adams actually has an interesting connection to game music because in Civilization IV, when you get to the modern era, you know, all of Civ 4, other than the famous opening title music, well, I don't want to say all, but a lot of Civ 4's in-game music is just period music, you know, recordings of classical, Renaissance, et cetera, et cetera. And when you reach the modern era, you start to hear John Adams. I believe the Chairman Dances.
Oh, nice.
I forget his larger orchestral pieces, whose names always begin with H. Harmonium is one, but I think it's the other one. Anyway, there's a lot of John Adams in Civ 4. So if you are a Civ 4 player and remember that experience, you have actually heard quite a bit of John Adams.
I love that fact, but also I'm really sad that I missed that because I played some Civ, but actually Civ 4 is in that hole that I just did not play Civilization for a while. I played Civ 2. Ostensibly for research purposes, but I actually honestly love that game. But then I went to some modern console stuff like Civ 5, and then there were those middle civilizations that I just totally missed.
Right. Middle Civilizations also sounds like a good name for a game. But yeah, John Adams is, I recommend listening to John Adams for all our listeners because he is the intersection of minimalism and orchestral romanticism. So a lot of minimalism tends to be stuff that feels austere and can try your patience. You know, it doesn't, it feels like an experiment, you know, some kind of avant-garde thing. And John Adams took the idea of minimalism and he made it lush and expressive. And the orchestration is mind-blowing. So it's even worth, if you're a student of orchestration, grab a score and see some of the detail work he's put into that.
That's a great recommendation. I couldn't have said it better myself. These modern concert art composers are great. I wonder if we're going to have many more of them. What with all the stuff in the last few weeks when it comes to AI in music composition? Have you been keeping up with any of that? Has any of that come up on your radar and your social media feeds?
Well, certainly ChatGPT has made a stir, I think, culture-wide. I think there's been a lot of marveling at how AI technology has suddenly become accessible to the person on the street. Well, probably not on the street, but the person at their laptop. And I've seen a lot of speculative discussion about what will happen with AI generative music and how that will impact composers and the need for new music. And there's the panic to content ratio tends to be a little bit high, but I think there's a interesting discussion to be had and an interesting question with respect to how AI will impact our fields.
Yeah, that's interesting. You mentioned ChatGPT because that was the first thing that I saw, not just in terms of the larger cultural zeitgeist, but also in terms of music production. There were a couple of interesting posts in these Reaper forums that I visit. There's the Reaper forum as well as these groups on Facebook. And there was a really dense period of 2 weeks where people were experimenting with using ChatGPT to create Reaper scripts in order to basically streamline workflow and see if it could actually do some proper programming. Elsewhere in the computer world, there were people talking about, hey, maybe ChatGPT will actually take our jobs as computer scientists or computer engineers. And there was actually a recent fun headline about how ChatGPT actually passed the L3 engineering job application for Google. okay, that's cool. That doesn't really affect me, but there were some people talking about how, hey, there's some things that I want to automate. I know that I could do this stuff in something like Reaper Rescript. What if I just describe the problem to ChatGPT? Could it actually spit out a working Reaper action that I can use? And there were a lot of very successful examples that people talked about. So that was actually really cool, and that got me really excited for those possibilities, the annoyances and minutiae that you have to deal with for making some of these DAW moves and stuff in order to, you know, properly make a project or, you know, execute some of the things that you're conceiving when it comes to structuring your music or sound project the right way.
Can you elaborate on what the scripts do? Are they strictly workflow related or are they musically generative in some way?
I think all of the ones that I looked at were workflow related and they seem to really resonate with me when it came to not exactly perfect overlap, but certainly enough with when it comes to rendering interactive music or spitting out different types of sound designs. So let's see. I think there was one example that was something along the lines of, hey, can you give me a rescript that will go through this process of muting and changing buses in the middle of iterating through rendering? So you would have a project set up. There's all these things that are set up there. You would just go through all these different permutations of muted tracks and routing so that you spit out files in a way that's perhaps more complex than what the Reaper's already pretty robust render matrix would give you. And I thought, oh, okay, that seems pretty cool. I could see how that would be really useful for me in an interactive music context where the render matrix is pretty great, but often I have to do things with my project where I'm either putting a lot of stuff in there and there's a lot of redundant material that I have to navigate through in order to make it work, or I have to remember some sort of heuristic for how to go through the routing in order to do something that's just a little bit more complex than what the render matrix would give me. So, okay, permutations of different layers of music tracks so that I don't have my game playing all the layers all the time and rely on its mixing in order to make things work, and I could potentially save on space or something like that. It was a pretty good example that I saw on the Facebook Reaper user group. And then that sent me down the path of seeing some other things around the Reaper forum. And again, a lot of them were workflow related, not so much things where you're writing notes, actually. It was a lot of it is engineering moves and setting up the project and the routing in interesting ways.
So when used in this fashion, AI is essentially a extremely high level programming language where you're simply stating your desired outcome and it generates the scripts at that mid-level programming language that give you the outcome you want. And this is very cool, and I continue to wish that either Logic had more flexible scripting or Reaper was less ugly so that I could do more automation. Logic does have some scripting, but it's, I think, very limited in scope. But I think this kind of use of ChatGPT or AI generally is not very controversial. I think it's cool. It's interesting. It can save us some time and take high-level scripting languages and abstract away so that they are even higher. And if you look at some of the controversy, I don't think many jobs are threatened by this level of automation. Mm-hmm. So I think where there's more interesting discussion is what happens as AI encroaches on creative domains. And I think there's a really interesting overlap here with what we do already and what game composers in particular have been doing for years and years with generative music and to some extent dynamic music, in-game generative music. Have you seen any interesting examples thus far of an AI used for generative music in a way that seems non-trivial?
Yeah, there's a couple of interesting ones out there. The one I'm most familiar with is the Google one. So there's this thing called Music LM. And basically it is a way that Google has, and it's not the only one out there, but it's a machine learning text to music generator where you basically can type in a prompt, much like ChatGPT, and it will, instead of generating more text, it will generate music. And you can say things like, I want a 2-minute piece of music that is primarily violin and viola over an ambient synth bed, and it will basically do that. There's a couple of demos that are out there. If you search for Google Research, the paper itself from Google is just called Music LM, Generating Music from Text. And if you search for that, you should be able to find this demo website that has a link to the paper, as well as various demos of audio generation from these captions, and I'll just read some of these captions. A fusion of reggaeton and electronic dance music with spacey, otherworldly sound. It induces the experience of being lost in space, and the music would be designed to evoke a sense of wonder and awe while being danceable. What does this sound like? Let's see if I can actually make this sound in here impromptu, because I haven't really set up my routing here, but Were you able to hear that sort of faintly there?
I was. I don't know how... Well, that did sound danceable, but I don't know how much of a feeling of awe that provided.
Yeah, it's... I mean, it sounds like music. I mean, that's the thing. It sounded very much like music. Very coherent. It had a pretty straightforward rhythm, but okay. There are a bunch of audio examples here. Again, if you just search for Music LM, you'll probably find the Google Research web link on that. And lots of examples. 30-second examples. They have long generation where it's just, hey, give me melodic techno. And it's just, there's 5 minutes of it. Bam.
Right. I think there's an interesting distinction between these very, what I'll call... low granularity or high granularity. Well, I'll call it high level music generation, because in this case, we're getting the entire piece of music. And presumably the training data is music created by people, right? I assume it's analogous to ChatGPT, where they just fed it the internet, set up a neural net, and allowed it to figure out how to divvy up the data that it was getting. But mm-hmm. that the music was, you know, originally trained from that it sort of reverse engineers music that has been written by human beings. Is that the case?
I guess so. Yeah. It actually gives you a link to the exact data set that it was trained on. And it describes it as 5,521 music examples, each of which is labeled with an English aspect list, as well as a free text caption written by musicians.
It's interesting.
Like, and so, yeah, you can actually download this whole thing. There's like megabytes of these, CSV files of data and audio. And it's really interesting. It's very cool that they give you this. But yeah, it's trained on this very specific data set, which is one of the, I know that's one of the big issues in other places when it comes to AI learning, a lot of the brouhaha when it comes to visual image generation and being trained on copyrighted work. But this actually seems cool. It's a publicly released Music Caps data set.
I'm guessing that since there's only 5,000 examples, there's probably some stylistic common denominator to all of them. Like they're all kind of rhythmic pop, but there probably isn't John Adams style music. There probably isn't truly ambient orchestral or certain genres that would be so far afield from what we just heard that I think an AI would have trouble coming up with principles just from 5,000 examples, because that's so few.
Yeah, it definitely seems like that to me too, but I haven't trawled through all of this data myself, but it looks cool. I've got it downloaded. 5,000 examples really isn't all that much if I really wanted to spend the weekend trawling through this, but I'll let someone else do that.
I think there's an interesting distinction here between this kind of high-order music generation and what we composers do all the time with tools. So there's a plugin in Logic called Drummer, and it generates drum patterns in various styles, and you can twiddle knobs to change certain aspects, like how often the drummer does a fill, how rhythmically dense the patterns are. And it'll generate essentially variations that are supposed to sound a little more human than just using a stock loop. And it will adapt to tempo. It will adapt to meter, which is interesting. So you can throw in a 5/4 bar. That would cause chaos with your audio loops, but your drummer plugin will handle that just fine. So that's a kind of AI, right? That's a kind of generative music tool. But it's rule-based. I mean, there may have been training data, but we feel like the programmers had more of a direct hand. Or the individual musicians who may have been the inspiration for each setting on the plugin, rather than just kind of vacuuming up en masse the result of unwitting composers' work.
Right.
And I think that's an interesting distinction. So there's both a distinction of training and there's a distinction of granularity, because the rhythmic variations in a single drum loop are not as high order in construction as an entire piece of music.
Since you mentioned drums, that's a place where when I think about my own composition process, I'm very much aware of the things that I care about and know really well, and the stuff that I'm like, whatever. Like, if I have to actually program drums for myself, I am not thinking about things like, those individual ghost notes that I'm going to put in on this particular beat. Instead, I'm just thinking, I need the drummer to basically keep a steady beat here and maybe sound a little more cool than usual if need be, but otherwise I'm not thinking about those things. On the other hand, with any other instrument, I do have that very fine tooth comb. I'm looking at it with with the microscope, and I care a lot about the attack of this note and how he actually sustains through the note and all that stuff. It makes me think about how much I sort of rely on perhaps my own understanding of certain aspects of music that are not quite as detail-oriented, and perhaps I only know, in quotations, on the same level as how I perceive this AI to actually know about the generation of any of this music that I'm listening to.
Right. It really is an interesting suite of related topics. You could say that. So you could say that delegation, musical delegation, is a broader version of musical collaboration, and that working with an AI is a more specific form of musical collaboration. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the traditional way to work with a drummer is you hand them a chart and you might write fill or, you know, get busier here, et cetera, but you're definitely not micromanaging the details. So it's not that different to hand a chart to a human drummer than it is from instantiating the Logic Drummer plugin and feeding it a tempo and meter map and letting it come up with the results.
Yeah.
They're both kind of the same thing. So then as we increase the amount of automation and delegation, eventually we get to just ask an AI to write the entire piece.
Yeah, maybe. I definitely can imagine some future, probably in the near future, where that drummer plugin is going to be something like me saying, yeah, it's going to be like this. And I kind of want it to be in this sort of Peter Erskine style or something. And I'm feeling a little bit more uncomfortable once I start thinking about the not so near future. And maybe that's even a little closer than I think it is, where they are in fact making those whole pieces because that's my livelihood, right?
It is, but I want to point out to everyone who's thinking about this fairly new topic, or at least it's a topic that's come to our attention recently in a new way, that we've always had automation of art on some level. And as I said before, game composers must know this better than most people because we have been experimenting with generative automated music for a long time. And even in providing stems, right, and letting a game dynamically remix the stems so that you've written 2 minutes of music and the game effectively gets 20 minutes of music out of it through the recombination of stems. Mm-hmm. So that's a form of AI kind of taking over the composer's job to a degree, because you only wrote 2 minutes of music, but the game got 20 minutes of music out of that because of automation. And, you know, automation is kind of a old-timey term, but, you know, I mean any kind of software process that generates new music. And, you know, going back quite a number of years, we've had literal generative music that might have been more tied to MIDI technology. But it's been there in degrees. And you can think of Spore, which was mostly a generative score that was very sophisticatedly mapped to different types of aliens and races. And the game would generally spit out music that was entirely procedural. So we've had this stuff for a while. So the question is, how much more should we panic now than we panicked in the past?
Yeah. You know, there's all that stuff. You use a bunch of different terms there. There's procedural, there's interactive, there's AI. I think they all sort of exist on this fine line. You know, when I'm thinking about a game implementation of an interactive soundtrack, I know that I could probably look at the FMOD project and the parameters, and I could look at the code and And I can see that, oh, there are all these different function calls happening. There are all these things that basically make up these algorithms. And I, as a musician, but also as a programmer and game designer, can really know at every single point of the algorithm what exactly is going on. Now, these things that we're seeing here with like MusicLM, that's pretty cool. And there's a lot of documentation there. There's these papers, there's the data sets that it makes available. I am not going to know that. You know, this is now much closer to a black box of a program where, yes, I prompt this thing and it's going to spit out music at me. And maybe that's the thing that gives me the anxiety, the black box nature of this. But, you know, there are also other things in game design that have a similar thing going on. Things like, you know, there are plenty of people out there who are game programmers that are going to be using things that are off-the-shelf products like SpeedTree for generating environments with lots of trees. And they're not going to be coders, or even if they are going to be really, really awesome coders, they don't have the desire to actually peer under the hood of what is essentially this black box piece of software that does exactly what they want, which is generate trees. But music composition is not the same as generating trees, or maybe that's just me being incredibly conceited there.
Well, I think this is the key issue. I think automation of craft and art is a continuum. Mm-hmm. And a lot depends on the nature of the product being automated. You could say, well, trees are kind of there's narrow variation. There isn't a lot of creativity in trees unless you're designing weird, like asparagus trees for an alien planet. You see, it's kind of a narrow problem and it's okay to have a software take it over. But you can look at all the types of music in commercial use and then say, well, certain styles of music, are they really that different from trees? You know, certain beat-driven electronic music using the same chord progressions, using the same sonic palette, using the same form and the same conventions of, you know, A section, B section, et cetera. How different are those from trees? And so much music has been written in that style, and to have a new person compose more music, it may just be kind of a simple variation of what's been done in the past. So could we not say that certain types of music are very tradition-based, are very formulaic, and in those cases, those seem more rife for automation. Again, my kind of old-timey way of just referring to a takeover of creative job by software processes. Then on the other hand, if we have a piece by John Adams, how's that for a topical touchback, where there is more creativity and more innovation than software is really able to do. I think there's a spectrum of creativity involved in music, and music that is more utilitarian, predictable, and formulaic is in a way already intrinsically imitative, and therefore is much more ripe for takeover by automation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I agree with all of that. I also want to add that not just in music, but also in games, there always seems to be an aspirational aspect to it, where you're talking to the music composer and the music composer wants to do something that is a little bit beyond what he had done previously with this new project. Similarly with the artists want to do something that's a little bit beyond what they had done previously. And the same thing with the programmer and the same thing with technical artists and game designers and everyone else there. So it's that all these tools here are really cool. It'll be really interesting to see how they manifest later. And there's so much stuff happening right now in this field that these things are going to manifest sooner rather than later in commercial products that are made for us working musicians. I'm pretty darn excited, and I'm looking forward to seeing what it can do to allow me to achieve some of those somewhat more aspirational goals that I'll have over the course of my career and whatever projects may come.
I agree with that. Both sides of that. If I interpret, you know, if I follow the cut of your jib correctly, one thing that software composers, that's probably a bad choice of words. One thing that AI music creating algorithms can't do is think outside the box, because they are by definition the box. And they can only, you know, in as much as they are innovative or doing something different or interesting, they can only imitate what people have done before. So what's a really good example? Like if you think of, how about the winner of that scoring competition a year or two ago, who took an action scene and kind of gave it like an 8-bit retro score and won. I forget if it was Spitfire or something else.
Yeah, I think it was Spitfire, and it was Westworld for the example, right?
Yeah, so like that kind of crazy out-of-the-box innovation, we think, well, probably software can't be any more creative than the designers and the people who are running it. So if you imagine a nightmare scenario where a producer of a game is like, I'm not going to hire a composer. I'm just going to type epic battle music. The results might be passable, but they will be more of the same, because the person typing that prompt into the AI does not have the musical expertise or creativity to come up with an interesting solution, and the AI can't fill in those blanks. So on that level, I think we can say that the truly creative aspects of human composers can't really be emulated in as much as they involve thinking in a new way. AI software that is trained on existing data has a limited ability to come up with new, you know, quote unquote ideas based on that training data. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, you need a human being who has an abstract representation of games and many forms of art and has ways of interconnecting those ideas that are not obviously doable by algorithm. That kind of composer still has a unique power. This is my slow, torturous way of getting around to an optimistic view of the future. Here's the simple version, because I was kind of wending philosophic there. To the extent that a composer's work is creative, innovative, and draws from a broad education of different forms of culture and different media to synthesize a truly artistic approach to scoring, that person, I think, is fairly safe from automation. To the extent that a composer is working in very well-defined genres and is not being particularly original, but just varying what's already been done, I think that composer might find themselves encroached sometimes by the advances of technology.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. I think I share your sentiment there that I'm optimistic. I've definitely seen a lot of people in social media talk about how this could be the death of us all, the death of the profession or whatnot. I don't think it's going to be the case. We're going to do things with them. I believe in not just myself, but everyone else out there that's a working composer. And I'm really excited to see what else they'll bring to the table, because I know what they bring to the table is going to be far more than even what I understand of them as a musician. There's going to be so much there that I can't even begin to fathom, and it will motivate something else beyond just what is being presented to us right now with this huge spate of AI development. It is great. It's actually really insane just how many different things are out there. And we've only just talked about this one, Music LM. There's a lot of other things that are similar technology, perhaps addressing similar issues in the same way or in a different way. There's one that actually reminded me of something else, and I wonder if you can remind me of what perhaps was an existing precedent. There is something out there called SingSong, which is another Google project. Basically, it's reverse karaoke. So you can sing anything, and then it will basically generate an accompaniment for you.
Oh, interesting.
And I feel like this isn't the first time that I had seen it. I think that there might have been something that was kind of like this, maybe not exactly as real time as this one is. Again, it's Google. So if you search for Sing Song, it should give you links to the paper and the data and demos and whatnot. But I want to say that Band in a Box actually did something very similar to this, just not quite as sophisticated. But of course, Band in a Box has been going on for literally decades.
Right.
So I wonder if you could perhaps refresh my knowledge or reconfirm that something like this occurred in here or maybe some other piece of software.
That does ring a bell. And I know that Apple has like a musical doodling app where I think you record music and the accompaniment follows you in real time in some primitive yet surprisingly sophisticated way. All the stuff is around and not shocking in itself. I think there's just a threshold of scope where AI starts to become disquieting. And it's not necessarily a qualitative jump. It's just somewhere around like 60 to 70% automation scares people. So, but hopefully by pointing out that there's been a lot of precedent, drawing analogies to the use of sample libraries as opposed to live musicians, drawing analogies to library music, I think the emerging composer need not panic. They are advised to keep abreast of development of the technology and to perhaps train themselves to use the technology, because an interesting application of AI in music might be something that serves the composer rather than replaces the composer.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I'm definitely looking forward to that time. Past me sometimes wonders what it would be like if I had started out thinking about these sorts of issues. I can understand a lot of people that are studying and are feeling the anxiety right now, but I feel like we've been at this for a while now, and the issues that we had to deal with back in the 2000s or the late 90s, those were not these issues. They were much more basic.
Right.
It seems like, oh yeah, we just need to get some sounds in the game. Can you help us with that? And that in and of itself was some, colossal feat of engineering, of politicking. It was really crazy back in the day.
Resource management as well, because games only had so much horsepower, and how much of that was going to be diverted to audio was a question of debate.
Yeah. Well, what were the first games that you worked on?
Let's see. I could answer that in two ways, and it depends on whether you're asking about a game that had conventional commercial release or a game that might not have had conventional commercial release, but might have been interesting in some way. So in the latter category, I'll start with the more conventional game. I think my first commercially visible game scoring project was a game called Jane's Attack Squadron, which was a World War II flying combat sim and part of a series of games of that brand. And I think this was the last one. So I was brought in for that. And, if I look at that project and compare and contrast to how I work today, leaving aside things like what DAW am I using and what plugins, et cetera, because that's not interesting. But I see both really interesting continuity and differences as well. Back then I was primarily an orchestral composer, and I still am today. That's my home base. That's where I start from. And of course I'll branch out to other styles of music, including some that have nothing to do with the orchestra at all. Mm-hmm. But for me, if we're all yo-yos, like my home position where the yo-yo is in my hand is the orchestra. How's that for a tortured analogy? So, and back then I was still doing, pencil and paper, and then to the extent that samples are involved, then do that as separate pass. Mm-hmm. That score was mostly live orchestral. What's different is there was so little reactivity. The music in that game was so not dynamic. It was really a series of loops with a few triggers. You know, now you're flying, now you're in combat, now you're dead. That was the granularity of responsiveness of the music. And I had nothing to do with the implementation. I literally lobbed the music over the wall of submission and said, good luck. And today I am much more hands-on with how the music is implemented in the game. To whatever extent I'm allowed to participate, I get in there and I play the game and I make suggestions and I say, we should have it react here, we should do layers here, and this is becoming too much of the same thing. So in that respect, you know, how I work is very, very different most of the time. The non-commercial game I worked on was sort of the opposite in both respects. It was for a company that was very cutting edge. It was very much on the cutting edge of topics that are in the forefront of discussion today, but it did not achieve a lot of commercial visibility. And one of the games that we did, I don't even know if we were calling them games. I think we were calling them interactive storytelling experiences, as was the fashion at that time.
Yep.
But it was a very character-driven story about two penguins who are on a iceberg that has gotten knocked out into the ocean. And one of the penguins is aquaphobic. So he doesn't want to swim to safety because he's afraid of the water. And meanwhile, there's a killer whale that's starting to circle that would like to have penguin for dinner. So the entire game experience was emotionally comforting your fellow penguins so that he would have the courage to swim for safety. In that case, we had a very sophisticated musical response system that with a lot of custom code, and I was very involved in the programming and the design of the music system. So it was very much the opposite of the one that was very commercial. This was kind of almost a laboratory game, but it was really interesting how it looked ahead to the kind of dynamic music that we take for granted today as part and parcel of what we do.
That's really interesting. Was this all around the same time, or did you do one before the other?
These were pretty concurrent. The two examples I gave, I was in-house with the kind of experimental laboratory game company, and at the same time, I was doing contractor projects for more conventional game companies at the time. And this was all kind of late 90s, early 2000s, that era. So I got to work on both kinds of projects at the same time.
That's really cool. I kind of wish I had that type of varied experience there concurrently. I sometimes feel like if I perhaps exposed to myself to a really wide variety of projects while I was starting out, I might have perhaps, I don't know, better? Certainly different than the trajectory I ended up taking in my career, but the way it ended up happening was I tended to work on just a few projects at a time, usually in-house. And working in-house at various game studios, one knows that projects tend to run quite a while, which is really different from if you're working as a freelance musician and you might find yourself bouncing around as different projects cascade and need you at different times. But for me, I've only worked at a handful of companies. The first company that I ever worked with was a company called Blue Label Games, and they made mobile phone games. This was back in the mid-2000s, so before the iPhone was a thing. Back then, the iPod was the hot thing. I did not have an iPod. I had one of those Creative Labs Zen players. But even before that,
32 megabytes.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, they were so cheap. You could just grab them at Fry's and you saved so much compared to an iPod, but certainly not a prestige item back then. But what was more important? No, the iPhone was not on the scene, and making anything for a mobile phone was an endeavor. especially making it for multiple phones, which is what you really needed to do if you were making games, considering how many phones were out there at the time. There were Nokia phones, there were Motorola phones, there were Samsung phones, there were Sony Ericsson phones, and all of them worked a little differently, even within a single space like Nokia. You could have Nokia phones that were powerful, Nokia phones that were weak, Nokia phones that had different keypads and arrangements. And we were trying to make games for all of these things. And for me, I was trying to make music and sound effects for these things. That was really fun. It was very, very challenging to make pieces of music that could work on all of these things, as well as allow for sounds to actually play. We were happy to have any sort of feedback, much less a really cool sounding sound effect for any particular bit of action that was happening on screen. You weren't having awesome explosions or cool lasers or UI sound effects. You didn't even have UI sound effects. You didn't have the space to actually devote to UI. And then on the music front, I basically got really good at SP MIDI, which was a type of MIDI that allowed you to define the priorities of MIDI channels so that you were always optimizing your polyphonic resources, whatever they may be. So if you were on a phone that only did four-voice polyphony, you could prioritize certain channels. And if you were on something like a really, really nice $300, $400 Nokia or Sony Ericsson, you could have the full 24 or 32 notes of polyphony that might be required for the piece to fully ring out there. But that was its own fun challenge to do that because you still wanted those low-end phones to sound good. The very first game that I actually worked on, and I don't know if it ever came out, was a game adaptation of a graphic novel called East Coast Rising, where you're basically pirates in the Northeast, basically sailing around what used to be New York. And there's a lot of pirate type hijinks going on, managing your ship, blah, blah, blah. It was really cool. And I had to do these things that kind of sounded like sea shanties, which worked out okay for low polyphony. But what ended up happening was I didn't actually even try to make anything that sounded great with using the full 32 voice capabilities of your high-end phones. Everything was just two voices. Let's make two voice pieces of music, and the second voice would be a deprioritized sort of effect sound where every now and then it might do the low note, it might do an effect of a double-tracked delay, but most of the time, if you had a sound effect, that would take priority over that channel. So it was more like one-voice sea shanties for this game.
But you would rather have one or two voices that you could rely on, I assume, rather than write this elaborate composition that might or might not actually play in full form at a given moment.
Yeah, that was exactly the idea at the time. And that was probably a good way of going about it because it did take me time to really understand the implications of channel priorities and really write to those possibilities. So later on, when I was doing some other games like, Contra and Castlevania, our studio actually ended up getting bought by Konami, and we became a Konami America subsidiary. And so I ended up doing some stuff for some Konami games, these games that actually had a history at the time of having good music and good production values in general. So I really had to just work at it. And having that practice, just trying to do baby steps to, this is what it means to really deal with lots of things going on in my MIDI track and really working the channel prioritization and moving things between channels and then patch And then doing program changes on those channels rather than changing priorities over here, and how you organize your project when dealing with this. You know, running Cubase at the time, it's not exactly set up in a really great way that you can visualize all these things that SP MIDI actually grants you feature-wise. So just being able to wrap my head around it and then practice it, and later on, I was able to do some pretty good stuff where I could have something that sounded really awesome on a full-featured phone and something that sounded very acceptable on your lower-end phones. But it definitely took me time.
In terms of sonic palette, was the situation comparable to general MIDI where you would specify, say, you know, snare drum, but you wouldn't actually know what that snare drum sounded like?
It was. It was very much like that. Although it was not quite, unfortunately, it wasn't a subset of general MIDI. It was more like parallel to that. So there were a lot of things that you could rely on as being the same. And then there were a lot of things that were just, oh, this is just wrong. You know, if you do, like strings two on a Samsung, it's not actually going to be strings two. It's actually going to be some sort of brass instrument that's really weird.
Wow.
It also reared its head towards the end. You know, general MIDI had a lot of things like helicopter and audience and gunshot. And Nokia was actually very close to general MIDI standard. A gunshot actually kind of sounded like a gunshot, if a very video gamey gunshot. Some of the other phones, like your Sony Ericssons or your Motorolas, they did not acknowledge that at all, and actually would be a very tonal, very instrument type sound that was there. So, it was fun, you know, and I just had to learn it. And because of the lack of documentation, as well as the sheer number of phones that were introduced every year, you just had to go through it and try it out. And also had to accept that you're not going to win every battle, because literally hundreds of phones out there in the world.
You know, I strangely am reminded of the problem of emoji inconsistency, where you type a smiley in one platform and it has a certain connotation, but in the graphic set of another platform, it might come across as sarcastic, or maybe it's a little too flippant when you meant something like kind of a mature smile. There's kind of a comparison to how different ideas of the same instrument might have completely different connotations.
I think that's a really good comparison there. I've definitely gone bit by that. And I was surprised when, you know, someone would show me their Samsung phone, which ostensibly is an Android phone, but it looks very different from my Android phone. This guy that with his head exploding looks different, and he perceives it differently. And I can understand why he perceives it differently, but, you know, I only know what I'm able to send out there in the world.
Yeah, It was a strange time, I think. The non-specificity of instrumental palette is something that I think younger composers might not be able to fully wrap their heads around. But the score could just sound completely different depending on what sound card the end user had.
Mm-hmm. I kind of miss those days. I'm thinking about the early 90s. When it seemed like everything was more or less understood and was on that continuum from, all right, this is sort of okay. And in that case, I'm thinking about Adlib, FM Synth. And then eventually you go up to things like, oh, hey, this Gravis Ultrasound, and the guys are able to load their patches so it actually sounds a little better. And it's basically the same thing, but better. And the guy that actually has something hooked up to the MIDI interface, and it sounds really, really good. Not thinking about you PC speaker guys. That was hell. I don't want to subject anyone to a PC speaker soundtrack.
There's a really interesting question, and it's probably too philosophical for the time we have left. We might pick it up when Alex rejoins us. But, here's a general form and a specific form of the same question. What is the best year to have been born if you want to be a game composer? And generally, if you look at the evolution of any art form, When in that evolution do you want to be a young newcomer? Do you want to be starting out? And there are two schools of thought. One is, well, mm-hmm. you know, as far into the future as possible, because tools are always getting better and things are always getting more sophisticated and you're always more capable of realizing your artistic vision, whatever it is. But there's another argument that says the best time to enter a field is when it is sparse, when expectations are low, and the technology is limited. So you can become a master, and then you can grow, and your career can grow as the state of the art does. And I think there are really interesting arguments to be made for both sides of that.
Yeah. I tend to go for the latter just because it's not and I'd say it's not just a matter of being able to see everything come up from nascent to mature, and you're able to mature with that and become a master, but also seeing the influence that individuals have over how these tools are being used. I'm kind of thinking, if I was born a few years earlier, maybe I would have come up in the tracker scene a little bit earlier. And as it was, I was this, you know, young snot-nosed kid in these spaces where there were these people that were extremely mature tracker musicians. And there was a good deal of overlap between those guys who were just amazing hobbyists in the tracker music world, as well as professional music makers in video game spaces, whether it be doing stuff on Super Nintendo or Nintendo 64 or on Amiga or for PC game soundtracks. It would be really interesting to perhaps shift where I grew up a few years back and perhaps could mature alongside them, as opposed to coming up and sort of seeing them as this thing that I was chasing. And I ended up chasing them into a totally different space because the world of tracker music sort of changed, and then video game music changed a lot with CDs in the late 90s and all that stuff. But maybe this is just me being a little grass is greener.
There will always be that. No matter when you were born or whenever you entered the field, you'll always have a probably yearning to both have entered earlier and later for different reasons. But let's put a pin in this. Maybe bring it back when Alex is here, and maybe we can formulate a theory of when one should be born relative to the start of a given art form.
Yeah, I think that's would be really cool. We've actually been going at this for a while. So maybe it's time to get into conspicuous consumption. Have you actually been playing any games lately or listening to some cool stuff?
Let's see. It was a busy week. I have not branched out gaming-wise considerably. I did finish watching Better Call Saul, the TV series, and with it, completing my appreciation of Dave Porter's score, which I think is fantastic. I think that score is stylistically interesting to game composers as well as film and TV and linear media composers. I think of it as post-apocalyptic country or maybe post-apocalyptic kind of Southwest blues. It's like as if you had a guitar center after the apocalypse and some roving tribes came and found the instruments and didn't know how to write country or blues or acoustic rock and just started having out the instruments. And they were very emotionally sophisticated, and this score is what happened. So it's a great show, but the music is also similarly with Breaking Bad, which uses a similar musical palette. I think from a scoring standpoint, it's really interesting.
Nice.
How about yourself?
I haven't been seeing anything new lately. If anything, I was retreating into the archives that I keep. I have way too many PlayStation 1 and Sega Saturn games, especially weird games that never made the jump over the Pacific. So I decided to go on a puzzle game rampage and play all these weird well-drop action puzzle games that never came to America because there were just so many of them. There's some that are a little more popular. You might have heard of things like Puyo Puyo or Magical Drop. And then there are some things that are just, what the heck is this? So there's this game that I found that apparently I bought back in 2015, but I just never bothered to actually pop it in my system since then. It's called Pukunpa, and I don't think it actually means anything. It's just some weird sort of funny onomatopoetic word that I think relates to the actual puzzle action that's there. But it's this thing where you have a well, much like Dr. Mario or Puyo Puyo or something like that, and you have a pair of colors, and you can rotate them. Except now one of the pieces could actually have another pair of colors inside of them. So you have two buttons to rotate left and right, and then you have another pair of buttons to rotate the other pair of colors that are inside that piece left and right. And it seems like, yeah, this might be a little difficult for people to actually get into, but I thought it was really fun. I'm really into well-trod puzzlers. I'm not so much into a lot of the cheap soundtracks that were made in this era, though. There were some very good video game soundtracks made in the Saturn and PlayStation era, partly because, hey, the musicians suddenly had access to Redbook audio or other streaming audio. But there were also a lot of games where just like those things were being elevated, the fidelity of Redbook audio is lost on these very, very trite music compositions that maybe they just needed someone to run something through Music LM. Maybe that really is the thing.
Excellent way to bring the topic back home to the beginning.
It was not my intention, but, you know, I like these games. Sometimes these games don't necessarily have my favorite music and sound effects. It just happens that way. It's okay. They can't all be winners.
Right. And again, as you go far back in gaming, the tools may have really limited what was creatively possible.
Yeah. I mean, that is true. But it is also similarly really awing and inspiring when you see what people were able to do. And actually, a lot of people still are doing with the old professional or even sometimes consumer gear of the early 90s. People with their Korg M1s and Roland 1080s, but also the consumer versions of all those things. The Roland sound canvases or Edirol sound canvases back then. They can make those things really sing, but it took a lot of work and skill and preparation in order to make that stuff happen.
The good / bad old days.
Yes, those were the days, indeed. All right, so it's been an hour, so I guess we can call that an episode. This was episode 237 of the Game Audio Hour. If you liked what you heard, feel free to support us by subscribing to us at your podcast purveyor of choice and leaving us a review to keep us in the forefront of the algorithm. You can also follow us on Twitter at Game Audio Hour, where we also post notices about future episodes, as well as try to support some other fun and positive voices out there in the Twitterverse. And of course, the easy way to do all of this without having to remember any of what I said is to go to GameAudioHour.com. So go ahead and do that while we try to find out what's causing that buzzing sound. Bye. There really is a buzzing sound. Do you hear that?
I don't.
Oh, man. Maybe it's just in how I set up my routing. I think everything is okay here, but...
Well, all right. Hopefully it didn't print a tape.